Welcome to this Peer Voice activity. To access the entire activity, including supporting material, go to www.peervoice.com/QJJ. This activity is supported by independent funding from Novartis. Welcome to this Peer Voice activity on heart failure. This activity comprises a series of 8 streaming episodes with international experts. At any time during this presentation, you may download supporting materials and share this activity with colleagues.
Greetings. I am Professor Javed Butler. I'm a cardiologist and a clinical trialist with Baylor Scott & White Health in Dallas, Texas, and professor of medicine at University of Mississippi. I am delighted to spend these few minutes talking to you about the importance of comprehensive and early use of guideline-derived medical therapy in patients with heart failure. Now, we all know that patients with heart failure are at a very high risk for mortality, about 50% five-year mortality risk, very high risk for hospitalization, and once a patient does get hospitalized, at a higher risk for recurrent hospitalizations and even further risk of mortality, poor quality of life, and high healthcare costs. All of these concerns can be mitigated substantially by providing good medical therapy. Over the past few decades, we have seen substantial improvement in both medical therapy and device therapy for patients with heart failure, depending on the phenotype of the patient, as well as systems of care and strategies to optimize medical therapy. Amongst all the options that we have to treat these patients, there are certain therapies that we consider as foundational therapy. These are the therapies that, in the absence of a contraindication or intolerance, should be given to all patients with heart failure, with reduced ejection fraction, and most patients with heart failure, regardless of ejection fraction. And these include ARNI, beta blockers, mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, and SGLT2 inhibitors. The data with these therapies suggest that they are associated with reduction in mortality, hospitalization risk, and improvement in quality of life. How much improvement in survival are we talking about? If you were to give dual therapy with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, so we are not talking about giving no therapy. If you were to give ACE inhibitor and beta blocker therapy, and from that you switch to ARNI beta blocker, MRA, and an SGLT2 inhibitor, we're talking about increasing survival on average by almost 6 years. So the benefits are substantial. Now, unfortunately, while the data with these therapies are well known, these therapies are not commonly used in clinical practice. If you look at the data from Europe, Asia, United States, all registries or other observational data, the use of these therapies in clinical practice remains incredibly low. Some of the registry data would suggest that comprehensive therapy is given to less than a quarter of the patient, and comprehensive therapy at appropriate doses are given to less than 5% of the patients. Now, why is that so? That's a very complicated issue. There are healthcare system-related issue, hospital-related issue, patient-related issue, but one of the biggest reasons is medical inertia, that the physicians and the nurses think about heart failure more as a symptom disease than perhaps some of the other diseases. We will never not appropriately treat high blood pressure or diabetes or dyslipidemia because the patient does not have much symptoms, because these diseases by definition are asymptomatic, right? So we treat the disease on the basis of what the guidelines are recommending. When it comes to heart failure, it is very common that patients are not given appropriate therapy because the patients are quote unquote doing okay. Well, the problem with that approach is that, one, it does not make sense for us to wait for the patients to get worse to give appropriate therapy. There's no reason that if they get worse that we will be able to reverse it. We have to treat upstream, and a lot of these patients will die of sudden cardiac death, and we may never get an opportunity to treat them more aggressively. Therefore, if you look at the new guidelines, and again, whether it's European guidelines or American guidelines, Canadian, sort of the global guidelines are now not only recommending that we need to give these foundational therapies, but we need to give these foundational therapies as soon as possible because we have clinical trial data with ARNIs, with SGLT2 inhibitors that even initiating in hospital in these patients improve outcomes for these patients. And then we have clinical trials, which are systems of care to give early therapy, shows substantial reduction in mortality, morbidity just within 6 months post-discharge. So the guidelines are not only emphasizing that we need to give comprehensive therapy, but we need to give comprehensive therapy as soon as possible, irrespective of other considerations in the absence of contraindication. Now, some of this can be eased by multidisciplinary teams involving nurses, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, doctors, all working together, and of course, patients as their own champions to improve their care. All of this is doable. So thank you very much for your attention. I hope this was of help, and please join us for the next episode.
Hello, I'm Michael Böhm from the Clinic of Cardiology, Angiology, at Intensive Care Medicine, University Hospital in Homburg, at Saarland University in Homburg, Germany. Welcome to this educational activity titled The Four Pillars of GDMT, Understanding the Why Behind Recommendation for RAS Inhibition. So I brought this slide to remind you to the recommendations of the European Society of Cardiology. You can see that the main pillars are ACE inhibitors or ARNIs, beta blockers, MRAs, dapagliflozin and empagliflozin, the so-called SGLT2 inhibitors, and of course loop diuretic if there is any fluid retention. All of the first four compound classes have shown a reduction in hospitalization for heart failure and cardiovascular deaths. So the first class is very important, and I picked the effect of the ARNI compared to the ACE inhibitor, which are both recommended in parallel. And here you can see the data from the Paradigm HF trial, which explores the difference between the ARNI and the ACE inhibitor in nalapril. And what you can see concerning cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization, that there is a 20% relative risk reduction by LZZ696, which is the so-called ARNI. You can furthermore see that the curves separate early and they further separate as time goes by. Looking at a more closer view on this, you can see that it's not only the primary endpoint, which is in the first line, cardiovascular deaths or heart failure hospitalization, but the approximately 20% risk reduction applies also for the components of the composite, that is cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization, as well, and that is very important, to all-cause deaths, the first and recurrent hospitalizations, and finally also to emergency department visits in these HFrEF population. Even more importantly, you can see that these effects apply to more or less all of the subgroups, and a selection is given here. It doesn't make a difference if patients are above and below 75. There is no age association. The ejection fraction, 35 above and below, there is no interaction. Kidney function, systolic blood pressure, and NT-proBNP do not interfere with the treatment effect of sacubitril/valsartan compared to enalapril. Furthermore, there are many data now highlighting potential mechanisms and patient-related outcomes. An NT-proBNP, cyclic GMP, of course, is elevated by the natriuretic peptide amplification, which produces endothelial dilatation. There is a drop in markers of injury like troponin or markers of fibrosis and markers of inflammation as STT2. There is also an initial small drop of eGFR, and then there is protection of the kidneys. And there is, most importantly, deremodeling. That means the ventricles get smaller, the atrial gets smaller, and the ventricular inflow is facilitated. And all of this translates into an improvement in quality of life and New York Heart classes. With this overview, I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to the discussions with you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I am Alexandre Mebaza from the University Paris Cité and the Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care and Burn Units at Saint-Louis and La Riboisière Hospitals in Paris, France. Welcome to this episode of Simplifying the Steps for Initiation of RAS Inhibition. We learned a lot on the implementation of GDMT in heart failure with the strong heart failure trials. Here you may see that two arms were compared. One arm is named high intensity care group. They got half dose of GDMT before being discharged from an acute heart failure episodes, and at week two, everything was done to have all the four pillars giving at a full dose for patients with heart failure, and this was compared to usual care. And as you can see here, there was a clear benefit in the high-intensity care arm with a marked reduction in rehospitalization and death, meaning that really it's the way to go to give a full implementation of those drugs within weeks before discharge and after discharge from an acute heart failure episode. Now, what is very important is in this study, we could show that if the patients are well treated before discharge, those patients will keep a high level of treatment within the next months, 3 to 6 months. As you can see here for ARNI, ACE, or RB, you can see that at pre-discharge, 80% of the patients were treated. And then you can see at week two, almost the same number of patients were well treated, and this was true for the next months. And you see that we had exactly the same figures for beta blocker and MRA. Then really the message is you need to start the treatment of heart failure. You need to start the four pillars before discharge. Now, does the treatment, the full treatment of the four pillars of heart failure, does it translate to improvement in outcome? The answer is yes. You can see here that for both all-cause death or heart failure readmission at 180 days or all-cause death at 180 days, you see that the more you give treatment to your patients, the better are the outcomes. Now, how am I going to use among the four pillars the ARNI? Two studies are clearly showing that you should start ARNI before discharge in the patients with an acute heart failure episodes. Here you see on the y-axis the NT-proBNP change, and you see that the patients with ARNI had a marked decrease in NT-proBNP, the best index of improvement in patients' condition. You see that this is much better in patients with ARNI. And you can see that it comes rather quickly. You see here already at 1 week, and in the following weeks, there is a clear improvement and better improvement in patients with ARNI. This is also true for those patients with a preserved ejection fraction. And you see that when they had ARNI before discharge, you see that in the following week, they had a lower NT-proBNP level. Now, the question is, how am I going to initiate or how am I going to push ARNI to the target dose? Let's say the patient came out from the hospital with an acute heart failure episode. He had no ARNI and you should start ARNI. And my advice is to start with what is named here the starting dose. Indeed, before you would check renal function electrolytes. And then the patient will go back home and you will see him after 2 weeks. You will check blood pressure. You will check biology again. You will check whether everything is fine. And then you will increase ARNI to the target dose that is written here. Now, for other patients, the patient may have had starting dose on the hospital. He will come. After a few weeks, you just have to do the same thing. And if everything goes well, you can push to the target dose. But when transitioning from ACE inhibitor to ARNI, it is crucial to have 36-hour washout period to prevent potential adverse reaction. Thank you for joining me. Please join the next episode with Tony Bayes-Janis.
Hello, I am Tony Bayes-Janis, and today I will be taking you through the key myths or misperceptions related to the safety of RAS inhibition, focusing on ARNI as a component of GDMT that often serve as barriers to initiation. So thank you for joining me today. First of all, let's check the pathophysiology of the RAS and the RAS inhibition. In this slide, you can see on your right that angiotensin 2 interacts with angiotensin 1 receptor, and as a result, we get all these deleterious effects, vasoconstriction, increased fibrosis and hypertrophy, and sodium and water retention. On the other side, we have the natriuretic peptides that try to counterbalance these effects, AMP and BMP interacting with the A receptor, CNP with the B receptor. In any way, these are transforming GTP into cyclic GMP, and the effects of cyclic GMP is vasodilation, reduced fibrosis and reduced hypertrophy, and increased natriuresis and diuresis. So we know that in heart failure, these natriuretic peptides are degraded by neprilysin, which transforms them into inactive fragments. So what happens when we give sacubitril valsartan is that this molecule has two components. The valsartan component, it's interacting with the AT1 receptor, and that blocks the deleterious effects of this RAS. So it suppresses the RAS in this regard. On the contrary, sacubitril interacts with the neprilysin enzyme, and therefore it enhances the natriuretic peptide system. It permits that natriuretic peptides interact with their receptor for a longer period, and therefore we have more cyclic GMP. This is the good guy. This is the one we want more, prompting vasodilation and reducing fibrosis, hypertrophy, and with natriuretic and diuretic effects, as we know. So when we are introducing sacubitril valsartan, sometimes we have fears. Is hypotension an issue? Well, in the PARADIGM HF trial, we see there are no significant differences between the two arms, the enalapril arm and the sacubitril valsartan arm, as you can see on your left. But what is important is that death after hypotension, if that happened, was significantly less in the sacubitril valsartan arm as compared with enalapril. So in a way, let's say that these drugs, they reduce blood pressure, but in patients with a baseline blood pressure of 100-110, you should not worry about that. Number two, what about potassium? When we give sacubitril valsartan in open dots as compared to enalapril in blood dots, potassium is better controlled. Potassium keeps better under the safety range. And this, even though these patients are treated with an MRA, so we know that enalapril caused more severe causes of hyperkalemia and more often led to discontinuation. And finally, a third myth or barrier to implementation is renal function. So we know that renal function worsens over time, and this is well reported. What's happening when we compare enalapril versus sacubitril valsartan, and particularly in the setting of diabetes where patients have worsening renal function as compared to non-diabetics. So let's see here in blue are patients without diabetes, and in red, patients with diabetes. We are assessing renal function over time. So in light blue and in orange, you can see the group of patients treated with sacubitril valsartan. So irrespective of diabetes, sacubitril valsartan is renoprotective, protects the kidney
And we can see that the slope is significantly less inclined in patients treated with sacubitril valsartan as compared to those treated with enalapril. And finally, let me go through initiation of sacubitril valsartan. If your patient is naive, the starting dose should be 49-51 in the majority of cases, unless there is a hypotension of 100-110, where I would recommend starting with 24-26 milligrams BID. If your patient is on sacubitril valsartan, this patient can go generally on 49-51 straight away. If your patient is on enalapril, it is very important to remember that enalapril and sacubitril valsartan should never be given together because of the potential risk of angioedema. So if your patient is on enalapril, you remove the enalapril, you keep a blanking time of 36 hours, and then you start your sacubitril valsartan. In general, consider 49-51, and you do monitoring. In general, we recommend, and the guidelines recommend, 2 weeks of a period time of 2 weeks to do the up titration to 97-103 BID, and this is the optimal dose. Remember, hypotension in general is not a major issue because the reverse remodeling caused by sacubitril valsartan oftentimes keeps the blood pressure up, so you should not worry much about that. The potassium is better controlled with sacubitril valsartan than with enalapril. And remember that the kidney function is better and the downslope is less when you give sacubitril valsartan as compared to enalapril. I thank you very much for your attention. Please join Professor Bong for the next episode.
Dear colleagues, I'm Michael Böhm from the Clinic of Cardiology, Angiology and Intensive Care Medicine from the University Hospital Homburg in Saarland, University in Homburg, Germany. Welcome to this educational activity titled Opening the Case Files. Is there such a thing as a stable patient with FREF, which is heart failure with reduced ejection fraction? In this session, we are going to explore a compelling clinical case that underscores the importance of a proactive and nuanced approach in the management of heart failure patients, especially those with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Our focus today revolves around the deceptive concept of a stable patient and the pivotal role of guideline-directed medical therapies called GDMT. Let's discuss Mr. Johnson, a 65-year-old gentleman who has been battling HFrEF. His NT-proBNP are currently at 1,500 picograms per milliliter, and his left ventricular ejection fraction stands at 37%. Mr. Johnson's current treatment regimen includes carvedilol, pyrazolamide, and lisinopril. While his condition appears to be stable on the surface, a deeper examination of his treatment regimen reveals no optimal gaps in implementing the optimal GDMT. During our outpatient clinic encounter, Mr. Johnson reports no recent episodes of heart failure exacerbation. His physical examination does not immediately suggest any instability or urgent concerns. However, this outward stability prompts us to dive deeper to truly understand his daily experiences and challenges, which might offer us valuable insight for therapeutic optimization. The use of targeted questions is pivotal to pick up on changes of his day-to-day function. These carefully crafted questions are not just routine inquiries. They are essential tools that help us understand crucial aspects of Mr. Johnson's health. By understanding his functional status, fluid retention, quality of life, and sleep patterns, we gather valuable insights into his overall well-being and any need for therapeutic adjustments. In assessing his functional status, we ask Mr. Johnson to describe his daily activities and whether he faces any challenges in routine tasks. His response revealed subtle limitations in his day-to-day activities, hinting at a potential decline of his functional status. Next, we turned our attention to fluid retention. We asked Mr. Johnson about any recent changes in his weight or signs of swelling in his ankles or legs. He mentioned experiences shoe tightness and mild swelling suggestive of fluid retention. When then explore his quality of life, how has his heart condition impacted his daily living? Are there activities he has to give up? Mr. Johnson speaks of increased fatigue and avoiding strenuous activities, which significantly impacts his quality of life. Lastly, we inquire about his sleep patterns. Does he experience any difficulties such as waking up short of breath? Mr. Johnson reports occasional nocturnal dyspnea, indicating potential nocturnal fluid shifts. This case highlights the importance of asking the right questions even when a patient appears to be stable. The ultimate goals in treating HFrEF are reducing mortality, preventing hospitalizations, improving quality of life, of course. According to the latest ESC guidelines, the four pillars of GDMT include ACE inhibitors or ARNI, beta blocker, MRA antagonists, or SGLT2 inhibitors. These therapies should be rapidly uptitrated to the highest tolerated doses. In Mr. Johnson's case, while he is on an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker, there is a clear need to consider adding an MRA and an SGLT2 inhibitor. This would ensure he benefits from all pillars of GDMT. The ESC guidelines recommend that these therapies be uptitrated to the maximally tolerated dose within 4 to 6 weeks. For Mr. Johnson's case, we are reminded that the critical importance of comprehensive patient evaluations. By engaging in proactive questioning and understanding the nuances of pharmacotherapy in HFrEF, we can uncover the need to optimize treatment, even in patients who might appear stable. Remember, every clinical encounter is an opportunity to reassess and refine our approach, ensuring that our patients receive the best possible care. Thank you for joining me in this exploration of heart failure. Stay tuned for the next episode with Professor Alexandre Mibatza from Paris, where he will delve deeper into the nuances of individualizing treatment and plans for heart failure patients. Thank you very much.
Hello, I am Professor Alexandre Mibatza, and today I will continue discussing the case of Mr. Johnson as introduced by Professor Michael Boone. Thank you for joining me in this episode entitled Following the Patient Journey, Can We Safely Initiate GDMT in a Hospitalized Patient? We remember Mr. Johnson, who seemed stable in his heart failure management but was hospitalized with worsening heart failure a week after his output clinic visit. Upon Mr. Johnson's admission, we conducted a thorough assessment. His rapid deterioration called for an immediate review of his therapeutic regimen and a strategic approach to managing his acute decompensated heart failure. Our primary goal was to enhance decongestion. We increased his diuretic dose to manage the fluid overload more effectively. This step was crucial in alleviating the symptoms of congestion and improving his overall clinical status. We then evaluated his beta blocker therapy. In Mr. Johnson's case, his heart rate was appropriately high, indicating that the beta blocker was at a suitable dose. Hence, we will keep Mr. Johnson at the same dose of beta blocker. We will neither stop beta blocker, as we will lose the benefit of beta blockers and GDMT, nor uptitrate further as Mr. Johnson is congestive. We will wait for complete decongestion to fully uptitrate beta blockers. Additionally, with Mr. Johnson's blood pressure within the normal range, we saw an opportunity to initiate ARNI. This transition from ACE inhibitor to ARNI aligns with the latest guidelines and is supported by robust clinical evidence, including findings from the PIONEER heart failure trial. Initiating ARNI during hospitalization can significantly improve outcomes in heart failure patients. We carefully planned the transition from the ACE inhibitor to ARNI, incorporating a washout period to minimize risks such as angioedema. The starting dose of ARNI was tailored to his specific clinical situation, considering his long-term ACE inhibitor use and recent medication changes. Alongside introducing a beta blocker and ARNI, we continued to reassess and optimize his entire medication regimen. This comprehensive review ensured each component of his treatment was contributing effectively to his heart management. Mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, MRAs, play a vital role in managing heart failure by blocking aldosterone. I remind you, aldosterone can cause salt and water retention. According to clinical guidelines from the European Society of Cardiology, MRAs should be administered to heart failure patients with reduced ejection fraction if symptoms persist and left ventricular ejection fraction remains under 35%, despite being on maximum dose of guideline-directed medical therapy, including renin-angiotensin system inhibitors and beta blockers. The recent addition of an SGLT2 inhibitor to Mr. Johnson's regimen is in line with emerging evidence on their efficacy in acute heart failure settings. A few trials have demonstrated that readily available SGLT2 inhibitor significantly reduce cardiovascular death and/or hospitalization for heart failure in hospitalized heart failure patients, regardless of whether the patient had diabetes or not. Since SGLT2 inhibitors have minimal side effects, they should be introduced at a full dose before hospital discharge, and indeed they need to be continued after discharge. In summary, Mr. Johnson's case highlights the complexity and dynamic nature of managing chronic heart failure. By capitalizing on the opportunity to optimize his therapy during hospitalization, we aim to significantly improve his prognosis. Our approach is not just about adjusting medications, but involves a comprehensive, evidence-based, patient-centered strategy to effectively manage heart failure. Thank you for your attention. In our next episode, Professor Tony Baez-Chenis will delve into the post-discharge phase of Mr. Johnson's journey, emphasizing the importance of meticulous follow-up and uptitration of GDMT in heart failure patients.
Hello, I'm Tony Baez-Chenis, and today I will be taking you through the latest chapter in Mr. Johnson's journey with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. As my colleagues, Professor Michael Bohm and Professor Alexander Mebaca, have detailed in previous episodes, Mr. Johnson's case is a prime example of the dynamic nature of heart failure management. In this episode, we will explore the impact of optimal guideline-directed medical therapy on Mr. Johnson's condition. When we last discussed Mr. Johnson, remember that he had been admitted because of a worsening heart failure event, and during hospitalization, Mr. Johnson has been switched from an ACE inhibitor to an ARNI and has been diuresed to improve his clinical symptoms. Mr. Johnson was discharged, and now I am pleased to report that he has been appropriately started on the four pillars of the GDMT for HFrEF, and these include an ARNI, a beta blocker, a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, and an SGLT2 inhibitor. One of the key aspects of Mr. Johnson's current regimen is the careful titration of these therapies to the maximally tolerated dosages. This process has to be done gradual and has to be patient-centric, focusing on Mr. Johnson's specific needs and tolerances. instead of starting each medication one by one, the current evidence suggests that it's better to start with low doses of the four pillars and then carefully monitor the response and make the adjustments that are needed to optimize efficacy while minimizing the side effects. Remember, SGLT2 do not need to be uptitrated, but the uptitration of the four pillars should be achieved within 4 to 6 weeks. Ongoing monitoring is crucial in managing heart failure, and this we need to keep in mind very clearly, because in Mr. Johnson's case, we regularly assessed kidney function, electrolyte levels, and blood pressure. In addition, we continued to use the target questions that we introduced in episode 5 to pick up on changes in his day-to-day functioning. These questions help us gauge Mr. Johnson's functional status, fluid retention, quality of life, and sleep patterns, providing valuable insights into his overall well-being and any need for further therapeutic adjustments. In addition, regular monitoring of NT-proBNP and ejection fraction are also recommended to identify the reverse remodeling process that we often see in patients with optimal GDMT. In this case, Mr. Johnson's journey beautifully illustrates what optimal management looks like in a real-world scenario. He has shown significant improvement in his symptoms and significant improvement in overall quality of life. In addition, his NT-proBNP went down to 450 picograms per milliliter, and his ejection fraction jumped to 45%, which puts him now in another category, which is HEF-MREF, or heart failure with mildly reduced ejection fraction. And now, importantly, he no longer experiences the subtle limitations in routine activities that he once did. His fluid retention has been effectively managed, evidenced by the reduction in swelling and the improved fit of his shoes with the proper control of weight. And very important, his energy levels have improved and allow him to engage more actively in his daily activities without undue fatigue. As we have seen in Mr. Johnson's case, the journey with HEF-REF is ongoing. The evidence we have today with the TREAD-HF trial underscores the importance of lifelong therapy, even when ejection fraction improves or normalizes. In Mr. Johnson's case, this means continuing his GDMT regimen to maintain his current level of cardiac function and prevent deterioration. We understand that stopping or reducing the medication could lead to a relapse in symptoms and a decrease in ejection fraction. So in conclusion, Mr. Johnson's case is a testament to the efficacy of a well-tailored GDMT regimen in managing HEF-REF. By initiating the four pillars of GDMP, titrating them to maximally tolerated dosages, and conducting ongoing monitoring through targeted questions, we have been able to significantly improve Mr. Johnson's quality of life and manage his condition effectively. His journey serves as an important reminder of the dynamic nature of heart failure management and the need for continuous patient-centric care. Please join Professor Butler for the next episode.
Greetings. I am Professor Javed Butler. I'm a cardiologist and a clinical trialist with Baylor Scott & White Health in Dallas, Texas, and a professor of medicine at the University of Mississippi. I am delighted to discuss with you briefly the multifaceted, multidisciplinary care of patients with heart failure. Why is it important, including engaging patients in their own care? Patients with heart failure require foundational therapy with four drugs, ARNI, beta blocker, MRA, and an SGLT2 inhibitor. But there are many other options for the management of these patients with other therapies if they are not stable on these four therapies or device-based therapies. And of course, there are other recommendations for diet and exercise and other aspects of care as well. This requires a multidisciplinary team of primary care physicians, of cardiologists as needed or subspecialists as needed, and other specialties like endocrinology or nephrology, depending on the comorbidities. comorbidity management in these patients is extremely important, because many of these comorbidities like chronic kidney disease or diabetes, atrial fibrillation, or other cardiovascular and non-cardiovascular comorbidities, if not treated effectively, will make it very difficult for heart failure to be treated effectively either. So multidisciplinary team becomes pretty important. Protocolized management of these patients is also equally important, because if one can develop protocols, and whether these protocols are embedded in electronic health record or just otherwise in the clinical setting, whether these protocols are managed by clinic visit, or in this day and age, you really don't need clinic visit for every step of implementation of guideline-derived medical therapy. A lot of these things can be done through telephone visits, televisits, remote patient monitoring. Regardless of whatever setting that you're in, implementation of guideline-derived medical therapy becomes easier if there is a multidisciplinary team that involves primary care physician, specialist like cardiologist, and nurse practitioners or clinical pharmacists or other clinicians as part of the team. Perhaps the physicians can initiate the therapy, make the plan, and the therapy is implemented and completed by other clinicians as well, like nurse practitioners or clinical pharmacists. Now, it is very important to make sure that not only do the patients get what is considered foundational therapy unless there is a contraindication, but that these therapies are given as soon as possible. The guidelines are now really focused not only on the provision of care for these therapies, but early therapy, because we have clinical trial data that suggests that the longer we wait to give these therapies, the higher the patients are at risk, and that these drugs, the benefit starts accruing within a matter of weeks. So early therapy also becomes very important. So then the question is, what should be managed in the primary care setting and what should be managed in the specialty setting? Well, there could be a very good case that can be made that all patients with heart failure should be managed as a team between primary care or specialty care. Now, when we talk about the guideline-derived medical therapy with foundational drugs, they can really be given in the primary care setting. However, for other aspects like missing a diagnosis, underlying diagnosis of etiology, or other cardiovascular comorbidities, perhaps a one-time referral to a cardiologist for all patients, and depending on the patient's stability, maybe once a year follow-up in cardiology can be justified. However, there are other signs and symptoms that suggest that the patient is in more trouble, and a close follow-up and teamwork between primary care and cardiologist is really needed. There are multiple other schemes as to when a patient should be referred. The one that I like is a mnemonic called I Need Help, I-N-E-E-D-H-E-L-P. I stands for need for inotropes. If somebody came into the hospital and required inotropes, N is for New York Heart Association, advanced symptoms like 3B4. E is for end organ damage like worsening renal function. Another E is for ejection fraction less than 20-25%. D is for defibrillator shock and unstable arrhythmias. H is for heart failure hospitalizations. E is for escalating doses of diuretics, so the stable doses are not stable anymore and they're requiring more doses. L is for low blood pressure. And P is for progressive intolerance to guideline-derived medical therapy. Actually, one of the biggest prognostic signs is for blood pressure, creatinine, potassium, what have you. Inability to tolerate GDMT is a really poor prognostic sign, and these patients should be referred. Now, we are clinician-focused here, but remember, we are all coaches. The patients are the players themselves. So patient education is critically important. Shared decision-making, educating the patients why comprehensive therapy is important, what side effects to expect, and how to manage side effects, not just to stop the medications altogether, are all very important. So patient engagement and family member or caregiver engagement becomes equally important. So thank you very much for listening to this series and for your attention. I hope this was of help to you and to your patients.
This has been an activity published by Peer Voice.